Welcome to TMI, a podcast by Henry Ford Jackson Hospital. And today we have a special episode. They're all special, but this one is pretty cool because we have Amy sitting here in the studio with us. Amy, welcome back to the team.
Thank you so much. I am thrilled to be here.
It's been a couple of years since you used to be on our marketing team here in Jackson, and now you're back.
I'm back.
Ready to take charge.
Ready to roll. Yep.
Yeah. So, you know, one of the things that you're going to be covering or working on here in the health system is women's health. So we have a women's health topic for the show today. Yes. Just everything like involved with, you know, stuff that I'm not as familiar about, but hopefully after today I will be a little more. That's not an excuse, that's a reason to learn more. So today we will be talking about women's health, and you know, since we work in the health system, we have this opportunity to talk with some of the brightest and most helpful people that I can think of. So Dr. Nguyen is with us today. She is an OBGYN physician here at Henry Ford Jackson Women's Health, and she's in the studio, and she's been here for a little while, and I just keep hearing amazing things in the community about your service here. So
glad to hear that. I really want to bring a positive impact. Thank you for having me.
Yeah. Could you tell us a little bit about what you do here in the health system and kind of what your normal day looks like?
Absolutely. So I take care of women all day long in any form, fashion, or capacity, whether it's in the office or in the hospital, performing surgeries such as hysterectomies, doing deliveries, C-sections, vaginal deliveries, seeing young ladies in the office with complaints about acne or birth control or heavy periods, missing periods, all kinds of things. So from young women to older women, anywhere in that spectrum, I help to manage some form or fashion of their health care.
Yeah, that's so important. Mm-hmm. And for people who are kind of approaching this, maybe even for the first time, I know there are a lot of younger people listen to podcasts like this. What is a, you know, when should women begin seeing a gynecologist, or what is kind of your role in the life cycle of women's health, and how does that change?
It's such a vast amount of care that we provide. And I usually like to start seeing young women around maybe 13 to 15. And that may sound, oh my gosh, that's a huge surprise. Actually, it's not. I usually encourage moms to bring their daughters in from that age range in that time frame, just so that they can get to understand what a gynecologist is, talk to them about what normal things occur with their bodies, whether it's physical, whether it's mental, talking about expectations for periods and kind of some of those feelings that they may not be comfortable sharing with their parents. That doesn't mean they're going to have an invasive exam. That just really is more to meet us, become comfortable with us, and make sure that when they absolutely need us, that they feel comfortable and okay with coming in to see us. So providing a safe space for them to make sure that they can become familiar with their health care.
Great. Yeah. And so how does that change over the course of someone's life? Do you look at different things, or I'm just interested in that.
Yeah, absolutely. That does change throughout life. So depending on whether you're pregnant or not and your age range, there may be different things that we may recommend or offer. So as I stated before, with young women from 13 to 21, depending on if they're sexually active or not, we'll have conversations with them, again, kind of preparing them for what to expect in regards to their bodies. Once they become sexually active, we definitely will recommend an evaluation to discuss sexually transmitted infections and things like that. And then at the age of 21, that's when we actually recommend pap smear evaluation. So pap smears, some people think that a pelvic exam and a pap smear are the same thing. So I hear that all the time. Well, I went to the ER, I had a pap done. No, the ER doesn't do pap smears. Pap smears are specific tests, so screening for cervical cancer. So that can be done during a pelvic exam. That's when that speculum is placed into the vagina. So everybody calls it this duckbill thing. So, you know, they're like, you're going to put that duckbill thing in my... So essentially what it is looking within the vagina, making sure things appear healthy, and then that's the pelvic exam. The speculum portion allows us to see, and then the second part, after we remove that speculum, we place the fingers into the vagina, and that allows us to feel. So not only do we do that aspect during the pelvic, we also may offer a pap smear, which is that cervical cancer screening. And that cervical cancer screening is important because what that does is it allows us to detect abnormalities before cervical cancer appears. And so we recommend that at the age of 21. And depending on your age, you may or may not have that pap smear every year at your annual exam. So from 20 to 30, it's recommended every 3 years. Once you hit 30, you also get HPV testing. People say, well, what's HPV? That's human papillomavirus. So that virus is actually the virus that in many women can stimulate development of abnormal cells, which if not detected will become cervical cancer in the future potentially. And so that's why we have such different recommendations now. And a lot of women get confused. They say, well, you know, I used to get a pap every year and, you know, I'm really concerned you're not doing pap smears every year. Well, the guidelines have changed a lot because women were getting invasive testing and treatment that they didn't need anymore. And so just like we don't get colonoscopies every year to screen for colon cancer, we don't need pap smears anymore every year to screen for colon cancer, or for cervical cancer. And the other thing is mammograms. So mammograms, depending on which organization you look at, are recommended at different ages. And so that might be at 35 for a baseline, 40, 50, really depends on which organization you're looking at. There's so many things I could talk about. I could go on and on.
I'm glad that you shared that the parameters around testing have changed. Being a mother of daughters, I'm, you know, trying to educate them that, you know, even though you're young, these are things that you have to be aware of. Mm-hmm. And when you talk about that, my question is, you know, if you have a family history that has high propensity for cancer, does that change the testing parameters or how often you would do that if you have a family member who's BRCA positive or you have lots of incidences of different types of cancer in your family? Would that change for a young woman about, you know, how often she should have a pap smear?
So that doesn't necessarily relate to the pap smear itself. Remember, I said the cervical cancer screening is the pap smear, and that may not necessarily relate back to BRCA screening, but that might relate back to their own personal history of pap smears. So if they have a personal history of abnormal pap smears, then that might redirect how frequently that they do undergo their pap smear screening. But in reference to breast screening and how we screen, that is going to be different because depending on whether or not you have a positive genetic history yourself of an abnormality such as BRCA1 or BRCA2, those are gene mutations that can put you at increased risk for breast cancer and ovarian cancer for those that don't know, that may change how the screening occurs, how frequently and what types of screening you will have, whether you have MRIs and mammograms alternating every 6 months or whether you just have normal screening guidelines. So to get more information on that, I would recommend scheduling an appointment with a gynecologist to review that if you do have a significant family history so that can be identified and then those next steps can be discussed so that you can make sure that you're following those guidelines.
Super. So can you share with us if someone, I think a lot of young females are, you know, oh my gosh, what is my first gynecological visit going to be like? They might be nervous or embarrassed. So can you take us through, if you've never been to one, what someone can expect when they're coming to get a gynecological exam for the first time?
Absolutely. So that's one of the passions that I have is making sure that I'm providing a comfortable space for people when they come to see us. And especially when it's their first visit to the gynecologist. So typically what will happen when you come see me specifically is talking about the history and then actually walking you through what the exam is like before we ever even start that exam. So showing what the speculum looks like, talking about what a pelvic exam is and what a pap smear is, just like I just did previously. So people are on the right foot to know what to expect and anticipate. And essentially showing them, pull the stirrups out, show them what they are. I'll help them put their feet there when they're ready and talk through each portion of the exam, where I'm going to touch, when I'm touching, just making sure you know that I'm not startling you. And sometimes even with saying, hey, I'm going to touch here or, are you know, those types of things that still may be startling, but I think it calms and settles a little bit more than just throwing the speculum in and, hey, bam, you know, we're done. I try not to do that. I want to make sure that people are absolutely comfortable in that experience. Breast exams, we offer that as well. Yearly, making sure we're not finding any lumps or bumps. We may ask questions while we're doing the exam. and always give an opportunity for the patient to ask questions as well. And I always check in and say, hey, are you uncomfortable? Let me know if there's any pain, because we don't know what you're experiencing. So it's okay to say, ouch. It's okay to say, that's pinching me, that's scraping me. Let us know so that we can readjust and make sure that you're not uncomfortable during the exam. The exam should not be painful if you have a normal pelvic area. Okay. It might be uncomfortable, but it shouldn't be painful.
Great. Wow, that's a lot. Sometimes I don't realize how complex the female body is. And like, it just being a guy, like, you don't think about those things all the time. So this is kind of eye-opening for me. Could you talk a little bit about like preventative treatments for some of the issues that you might see? Like, what can women do to, like, you know, if they're experiencing issues? We have a couple topics here. Some of the most common topics that you experience, like, what can ladies do to, you know, help with that?
I have a few heavy hitters, and we can talk about those. So one of the biggest complaints that I get from women is, it might be a little uncomfortable for you, but it's vaginal discharge.
Yeah.
And so, you know, we talk a lot about what expectations for discharge are, how to manage not making it worse. And what do I mean by that? There, our body, just like we have saliva in the mouth, the vagina is a self-cleaning organ. It is supposed to clean itself out. And so what happens in some women is they are kind of grossed out by the fact that that is the case, and they will overwash, overclean, use things that will make them uncomfortable, and they end up in the office with a complaint of irritation and itching. And so that's a very common thing. So the things that I recommend would be avoiding harsh chemicals in that area, never using antibacterial soaps in that area, because you're washing away that normal bacteria that's there that helps to keep that area healthy. So we have a bacteria there called lactobacillus, which helps balance the vagina out so that we don't get overgrowth of those other things that cause the odor and irritation and itching. So that's one of the big conversations that I always have with women about preventative care. No douching, no heavy scented lotions, items. You know, try not to shave your hair off completely. That's another big thing that can cause, you know, razor burn, discomfort, all kinds of things in that area. And again, see the gynecologist if you're having trouble. You should not have to use Monistat every month. There's something going on if you're going to Walgreens monthly and taking things off the shelf to treat something. So that's one of the big things. I could go on and on.
Yeah, please do.
Well, if I can ask or add something too, is I think going back to, and you know, I'm always thinking about younger women, but is it safe to say, like, the worst thing that you could do is blow it off because you might be embarrassed?
Absolutely. Do not be embarrassed. We see so many things on a daily basis, and you're probably the third or fourth person that I've seen that day with whatever complaint you have. Mm-hmm. So it is not out of the norm for someone to feel uncomfortable discussing it, but we're a safe place to make sure that you can have your women's health care needs met. And we do not want you to be in a position where you avoid because you're concerned or because you're embarrassed, and now there's more of a problem that we have to manage, which is a little bit more difficult sometimes because things have been delayed. So never feel embarrassed. I've seen it all, I promise.
So you said you had a couple heavy hitters and you shared one. What's another heavy hitter?
Another heavy hitter is bleeding. So women have a lot of complaints about their menstrual cycle, whether it's painful menses, whether it's, you know, irregular menstrual bleeding, whether it is just they bleed too much. And so there's a range of expectations that we have for those. How long should your period be? How heavy should it be? What is a normal amount of discomfort that you should experience? If any of those things seem out of the norm, it's okay to go to the gynecologist, and it's okay for the gynecologist to say, no, that's normal, or no, that's not normal. And we provide those parameters for you, and we can give you guidance on what to look for, how can we make you feel better, how can we treat it. So that's another big thing. And then obviously birth control. You know, our pregnancy rates, depending on which county you're looking in, can be quite different. But it's okay to become pregnant. But if you don't want to become pregnant, we have many solutions to help, you know, provide safe protection from pregnancy.
Yeah, and I heard that there's some that are even like a yearly form of birth control. Could you speak a little bit about that, or like what that entails, like how effective that is?
So there are so many types of birth control. That could be a conversation in itself. I've done some casting on Facebook previously just on the topic itself of birth control, and that was probably 30 minutes by itself.
Right.
So we look at birth control in aspects of things that you have to do every day and things that may last for many years. Those are called long-acting reversible contraceptions. So those are the most effective forms of birth control. So we really like those in women who don't want to conceive soon, you know, young teens, women who that's just what they want. And so it provides, you've got 3-year forms, you've got 5-year forms, even 8-year forms, 10-year forms. So those are intrauterine devices. So devices that go inside of the uterus. Some have hormones, some do not. There's also a device called a Nexplanon that lasts for 3 years. That's a little device that goes in the arm, and it just releases hormone over the 3 years, and it helps to prevent pregnancy as well. As well as some other things such as birth control pills. Obviously, you have to take those every day because they will wear off, and you put yourself at risk for pregnancy if you're not taking that daily. We've got patches, we've got rings, we've got shots, we've got, you get a pill and you get a shot and all of that. So yeah, there are so many different things that we can utilize. And so one of the things that I always recommend is schedule an appointment, talk with your doctor, and we're able to do a specific evaluation of you. What are your risk factors? How is your health? What are you looking for? And then that provides an opportunity for us to give you all of your options, their risks, their benefits, and then what may work best for you.
Yeah. Well, along those same lines, like my family, we have 2 kids and we've used various birth control in the past, and now we're not really looking forward to kids. But I hear from a lot of people that like we're over the age of 40, and like that's kind of like an area where people tend to have a lot of questions about, you know, moving forward with a family. Like, What are your thoughts on like the safety, or how common is it for people to have children over the age of 40, and how does that all work out?
So there are some things to consider. That does not mean that people over the age of 40 cannot conceive and cannot have a healthy pregnancy. And what's interesting is that at the age of 35, women are considered elderly when it comes to having children. Isn't that terrible? Isn't that terrible? Wow. That's just me.
Yeah.
And I say that because when you look at men, they're like, oh no, 50, that's called elderly when it comes to, conceiving. So, you know, and that's all based upon genetics, right? So as we age, our eggs that women were born with, like we were born with all the eggs that we're ever going to have. And so that means as we get older, those eggs are also getting older. Guys, they make their sperm on a regular basis. So how they develop it is quite different than how we develop our eggs that help create a baby, right? Wow. So as we get older, those eggs just don't function the same way. And so now there is a higher risk potentially of having some chromosomal issues. But even still, the majority of women that will get pregnant will have a normal pregnancy. Fertility will decrease over time as well. So while infertility may be less than 10% in 20-year-olds or 25-year-olds, infertility may increase to 30% in women over 40. So it may be more difficult, but if you consider 70% of women still may have a pregnancy in that time frame. So while it may be a challenge and there may be some assistance needed, there may be some differences in outcomes such as high blood pressure, or diabetes in pregnancy, things like that. I've had many women in their 40s that have had normal pregnancies without issue. So again, it's one of those things where I say have a conversation with your healthcare provider and determine what's going to be best for you.
Dr. Wynn, at what point should a woman say, you know, we've had trouble conceiving? At what point should they be concerned or seek out assistance or fertility treatment?
So depending on the age, again, remember we talked about the spectrum, and depending on what age you are, what do we recommend? So 12 months of actively trying during your fertile time of the month. So you can't have sex the day after your period, and that's the only day you have sex during the month, and say, I'm infertile, because you're not having sex at the right time, right? So you have to figure out what is the most optimum time during the month, and then for 12 months, have sex unprotected. And at that point, under the age of 35, under the age of 35, we tell you to try for 12 months, okay? Between 35 and 40, we say try for 6 months. And then after age or 40 and above, 40 and above, it's we want you to see someone yesterday.
And I hear there's a lot of like new tools or like ways to like track those kind of things. Like, for example, I saw in an update to my watch that there's even like menstrual tracking apps like on your phone or your watch that can help you with that process.
Absolutely. So the menstrual tracking, when you do it digitally, it is interesting because when you look at it, you can track the length of your period, so the time that you're bleeding, and then you can also track from the beginning of one menses to the beginning of the next. And over time, with the AI, that's what's interesting, it tries to look back and see what is your most prime optimal time for ovulation based upon that. And one of the things that can become difficult is if you don't have a regular menstrual cycle. And so we can't always pinpoint what your most optimum time for intercourse is or when you're supposed to have sex to conceive at time of ovulation if your cycle is very irregular. But these digital apps somehow have kind of created a way to provide that information for you. I don't know if it's a mathematic algorithm or what, I'm not sure. But what I will share with patients is, hey, go ahead and do the ovulation predictor kits during that time and see if it's matching up with what the app is actually telling you.
Yeah. I wish that kind of stuff was around from when we tried to have kids. Like, we tried for 5 years and it was a interesting experience. We went to a specialist in Ann Arbor and used off-label drugs and all sorts. It was strange, but it all worked out. So
awesome.
It's great to know that that's such a important space that people are focused on to really, you know, naturally help people, you know, make their way through it. So I guess looking forward for people, what are some tips that you have for people to kind of maintain, you know, their health, their just a basic good gynecological health? Like, what are some of the things you'd tell somebody as like a good rule to follow?
To follow for their maintaining their GYN health?
Yeah.
It's absolutely making sure you develop a good relationship with your gynecologist so that, as we spoke about before, making sure you're open, not leaving out things such as pregnancies that you're embarrassed about, because that's important information for us if, you know, something develops in the future and we don't know about certain things. Also, just, again, being open and honest about the things that are bothersome to you. Don't be afraid to ask questions, making sure that you're doing your role, doing your part in taking care of yourself. So I always talk about a partnership. So I'm your healthcare partner. And I'm invested in making sure that you are doing your job as well when it comes to taking care of yourself. We all sometimes will neglect ourselves and expect others to try to fix us. But if we don't work on fixing ourselves, it makes it challenging for those that are trying to help us. So I always ask that, you know, you do your part. And in doing your part is making the choice, you know, making good choices in exercise and nutrition and sleep and all those things that, you know, are pie in the sky, idealistic views of how we should live life. But what it boils down to is when we don't do those things, personal experience, you start to break down and fall apart. And so you have to make sure that you're making time to those suggestions that we give you, not blow them off.
That's great.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's great because, you know, it's so important to stay healthy and stay, because physical health, mental health, all that kind of thing, just such an important topic. Great. Well, I'm glad you could come in and talk with us a little bit today.
I was happy to be here. I love talking about women's health. It gets me going. Continue.
That's awesome. Yeah. Well, I'm sure we'll have you back for maybe birth control talk.
That would be amazing.
That'd be a fun one. So thanks for coming in. And if anyone listening to this would like more of these podcasts, and get subscribed and get ready for the next one that's going to come out, and probably another one with Dr. Nguyen here soon. Join us on the podcasts are available on iTunes, on Spotify, anywhere that you can find a podcast, and on henryford.com/podcast. So thanks for joining us once again, and this was such a fun experience.